Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm really pleased because we are doing part two from last week with Dr. Richard Wagner. And he is on the line, I'm told, by our producer. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Diana.
It's good to have you. And the
it's
PRN,
good to be had, don't you know?
What's that?
It's good to be had.
Yes, don't you know?
At our seriously advanced age, don't you know?
Yeah, well, let's not talk about advanced age because we're both quite vital.
That's
and
true.
And having fun with sex. And,
yes.
And isn't that about, I mean, you're not, I mean, we're going to talk about this because your wonderful book, The Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, Enhancing the End of Life, which we talked about last time, and I want to just review a few of the initial questions as part of the introduction for you.
Cool.
But, yes, you know, you're not dead till you're dead, and you might as well really enjoy life, and sexuality is such an important part of that, in your view and in my view, and, you know, we want to win some people over, don't you think?
I think so, absolutely. And, you know, as we talked about last week, there is a real spectrum in terms of sexual expression, everything from intimacy to full-blown genital expression, and all of that is part and parcel of having a happy, healthy, integrated life, it seems to me, even to the end of life.
Yes, and that's what your chapter six is what we're going to be focusing on, because your chapter six is about sex and intimacy. And but let's back up a little bit for those people that didn't hear last week's show. Of course, it's archived, and we're working with Progressive Radio Network to get the correct description up there. There were some problems, and then to get your book covers image up there, and that will be corrected, I'm certain, by tomorrow. But just as a review, I think it'd be so interesting for our listeners to know, because you are such a fascinating guy, Richard Wagner, what led you into this line of work?
As I mentioned last week,
yes.
My first calling was to be a Catholic priest, and I was for 20 years of my earliest adult life. And that wasn't a particularly happy association, even though I'm the only Catholic priest in the world with a doctorate in clinical sexology.
You're the only one, Richard.
The only one in the world, that's right, and which explains why my priesthood in ministry basically went the way of the dodo bird. Anyhow, while my ministry was falling apart, it was happening at the same time as the AIDS crisis was in ascendance in San Francisco, where I was living, and which was pretty much ground zero. And I was involved with a whole lot of people who were dying. I mean, it was one death after another, and it was very hard to keep up. And the long and short of it was that I had a terrible bedside manner before the crisis, and during the crisis, I learned to sit with death and not be afraid. And that changed everything, absolutely everything for me. Years later, I founded a nonprofit organization called Paradigm Enhancing Life Near Death. We started doing these wonderful workshops, which were a 10-week commitment, 2 hours a week, that covered lots and lots of topics about the end of life. And that's what gave rise to the Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, which is the book you referred to at the beginning of the show. It is basically one of these workshops in book form.
And it's a wonderful structure. You've got this group, and I guess it's compiled of a number of different characters, but
right.
You give them all names. And it's deep and profound, and there's so much in the book to enhance the end of life, if only a person who is experiencing a chronic illness or is very elderly, if only they would face this. And I guess that's pretty hard for a lot of people, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, my philosophy is, and
yes,
we talked about this too last week, is
yes, we
that
did.
The end of life begins the very first day that we draw our first breath. And, you know, everything else, we're on that trajectory to the end of life.
Yes.
And none of us is guaranteed X amount of time. None of us come out of the womb with, you know, some piece of paper that says, you know, we're going to live till our 70s or 80s or any of that kind of thing. And so we're all mortals. We're all facing the end of life, even those of us who are happy and healthy and, you know, haven't got a care in the world. Maybe that's the best time, to my mind, to focus on this particular issue, not because it's crunch time. You know, it's like, you know, studying for an exam. I mean, the mm-hmm. worst time to study for an exam is the night before.
And another question that I asked you last week, but I think it fits into the beginning of this conversation for part two this week, and you've touched on a little bit, but how it's affected you personally. You did say that you found that you were able to sit with death. I've heard from, and I want you to expand a bit more on that, but I've heard from other people that are hospice workers that sitting with death and the end of life can be quite profound, quite profound.
Right. It's very compelling. It's very
compelling. Yeah.
It's life altering. I was telling you last week about mm-hmm. how I was estranged from death. I as a younger man, this was very confounding to me. I was frightened by the whole concept.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing in my training, either in seminary or in school, preparing me as a therapist that made me consider my own mortality. And so when I had to do that because of the people that I was working with in the early 80s, I was completely unprepared. So this was a life lesson that I'm enormously grateful that I had. And as I said, it changed everything. It changed my whole perspective about what is important in life. And no one, absolutely no one that I know that has had a close encounter with death, either personally or with somebody, you know, that has been very meaningful in their life, that has come away from that experience saying, you know what, I had to readjust my priorities in life. That, you know, my interests, my concerns, what, you know, drove me, what motivated me, what was my passion, changed after that, because it is life altering. I mean, one's mortality is life altering, and the way that we find out how life altering this is by asking a real simple question to ourselves and say, if a doctor gave me a prognosis of 6 months, what would I be doing different today than I did, you know, before I got the prognosis? And right away, people will be shocked into saying, well, you know, this is not important. This is not important. Chasing after that is not important. You know, going to, the, you know, here is not important. The most important thing is to be around the people that I love, that, you know, that will nurture me at the end of life. All of my priorities shift and change. And if you can ask yourself that question, and you can come away from asking yourself that question with, you know, I'm going to continue to do the same thing that I did yesterday as today, then I think you're on the right path.
Yes. So, very, very important. If I had 6 months to live, what would I change? Crucial question.
Most assuredly.
And it certainly puts into perspective priorities and what's really important. And I think most people, it boils down to the bottom line. It's the people that I love and the people who love me.
Right.
Isn't that what you have found, too?
I think so. You know, and being able to be gracious and grateful for the things that come our way, even the things that are adverse in our life, being grateful for that, because those things really shape us, too. I mean, in fact, you know, my philosophy has always been, particularly when I'm doing therapy, is the things that we avoid tell us a whole lot more about the, about us than the things that we naturally gravitate toward.
So, can you come up with an example of that? Because I think that's profound, Richard.
Well, thank
things
you.
Things that you avoid can tell you quite a lot.
Well, you know, like I'm doing therapy. Let's say I'm doing sex therapy with an individual and a couple. And I'm asking some questions, and I can tell that in some line of questioning, let's say in terms of, you know, masturbation or something like that, and you know, the person is really forthcoming, you know, and is telling me, you know, what's going on. But I ask another question, like in terms of partnered sex, and then they deflect and they dance around it or avoid it or something like that. So I'm getting the information that I really need. It's through the back door, sadly, but you know, I am getting the information, and that is that the problem lies here and not over there. And I learned that because the person had was having a real difficult time telling me the truth or really basically even articulating what it was that he or she was having a problem with.
Yes, that's and I could echo that, but you have verbalized it in a way that is very useful. In your chapter 6, Sex and Intimacy, you bring in your old friend Cheryl Cohen Green, and of course the movie The Sessions was based on her life,
right?
Her life as a surrogate, and if people go to Cheryl Cohen Green with an E at the end. com, you can read about her new book, and it is my hope that I'll have her as a guest pretty soon.
I hope so too. You'll love her.
And I did listen to the podcast on your website. Well, you have a couple of websites.
Com.
Yeah. So say that again for the listeners.
It's drdicksexadvice.com.
Yeah. Doctor is DR.
That's right.
DR doctor.
And there's a
Dick.
That's all you have to do is type in the search function in the header Cheryl, even just the word Cheryl, and it'll come up. Two 30-minute shows that I did with Cheryl back to back are there, and it's a joy. She's a wonderful woman, outstanding personality, and a great sex positive educator and
therapist. She's pretty amazing, and to have a movie based on her life,
I know.
Well, what an accomplishment.
Helen Hunt could play me in the movie if she wanted to.
Yeah. She says in your podcast something that I know, that you know, that communication is 90% of sex problems. You know, people don't really have the ease to talk about problems, sexual problems.
We talked about that at the end of our show last week, you and I, Diana.
Yes, we did.
Recall. And we were talking about something very similar to this, and that is that sometimes we go on autopilot. You know, in relationships in particular, our partner or partners, you know, we don't check in with them. And, oh, you know, she's always like chocolate, or, oh, she's always like this, or, you know, he's always done it this way. But when we fail to check in, we fail to understand that people grow and develop and move and change, and their priorities and their interests and their likings even change right along with that. And if we start doing, if we continue to do everything the same old way without checking in, we fail to understand that. And sometimes we do a disservice to ourselves as well as our partner because, you know, we are doing something contrary to their interests or their wishes now.
I have found over, we've been in practice very 30 plus years, so you and I are similar, that assumptions and expectations often get people into trouble.
Right.
Yeah, to assume that they're the same way, that they like the same kind of stimulation is a mistake. To have expectations that you haven't checked out, it's a mistake.
Right.
So it's all about sex talk, sex communication.
Right.
And I know
if I like to have the same stimulation as I did before, but my body, because of an aging process or a disease process or what have you, has changed in such a fashion that now I need something different in order to achieve, you know, the same level of pleasure that I once had. It's not by choice. I would love that you continue to do that, except that my body is not responding in the same way. Like, you know, with intercourse, because of the aging process, I need a whole lot more lubrication than I ever did before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we don't know that, or if my partner doesn't know that, you know, it's going to be difficult.
So we need more lube, and we might even need some vibrators.
That's right.
And I love that on your site you also evaluate sex toys.
Yes, DrDickSexToyReviews.com.
Yeah, when did you start doing that, Richard?
Oh, gosh. Shortly after I started Dr. Dick's Sex Advice, people kept writing to me and asking me for advice about sex toys and adult products. And I thought, well, you know, I'll start a review site and start reviewing them and, you know, get a cadre of people together who could help me, you know, single people, gay people, older people, younger people, all to review these products. And then they're really honest reviews, and you can read them and, you know, buy or not buy as you see fit.
It's very helpful. It's very helpful for a lot of people. Let's go to your chapter six in The Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, Enhancing the End of Life. So you have Cheryl Cohen Green, and as we've already said, her life is reviewed in The Sessions, the wonderful movie with Helen Hunt and John Hawkes. But in your group, and she was really there in your group and brought out all of these things.
Yes.
So her question on page 193 that I'm looking at, so she asks, how important is sexuality in your life? And before that, she says, sexuality and intimacy are important topics for us to consider because there's so little information out there about these things for elders and those of us who have life-threatening conditions.
Right.
And so she says, well, the assumption, I guess, is that sick, aging, and dying people don't have sexuality and intimacy concerns. So why even bring it up? Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. You know, when I met Cheryl back in the mid-1990s, she was just recovering from cancer herself.
Mm-hmm.
And then she started doing these programs as a participant, and then she brought some people with her to do ongoing programs. And then finally I said, Cheryl, you know, why not come and do the presentation about sex and intimacy? And she was glad to do it, of course.
Yeah.
And because she has such a wealth of information, and, you know, she's been a surrogate partner for, oh, gosh, you know.
Well, she says 38 years.
There you go. Exactly that.
I went to her website, and it's wonderful. It's Cheryl Cohen Green. I mentioned this already, .com. But she says on her website, 85% of her clients are men, and a lot of their concerns are rooted in early trauma or shame.
Yes.
So she's very wise.
Oh, gosh.
She's very wise, and she really helped you with your groups.
Absolutely.
And she says in your book, and this is so helpful for so many people to read, even if they're not dying or have some chronic illness, and we're going to talk some about that, our culture is plagued with mixed messages about sexuality and intimacy. And isn't that the truth?
Yes.
Yes. She also says, in your book, have a little fun. Sexuality isn't a mystery. It's a wonderful miracle.
And she believes that. And, you know, I certainly do, too. And I know that you do as well.
I do.
And we live it, you know. And it's not something that we spout out about because, you know, this is something that we learned, you know, in a book someplace. We actually live it. We know it to be the case. And I think that's what makes, you know, Cheryl's presentation, both in my podcast and also in the book, so compelling, is that, you know, she is just so alive with this message.
So really authentic.
Absolutely. Not a false bone in her body.
Yeah, and people, I suspect your clients, I know my clients respond to my sex positive messages, to my sexual cheerleading, if you will.
Yes.
That life is better when we have really hot sex and good sex and compelling sex and fun
sex. Joyful
sex. What is that?
Joyful sex.
Joyful sex, indeed, joyful sex.
And however that is for you.
Exactly.
However it is, you know, for anyone who is in our audience, it's not the same thing for everyone. You know, hot sex could be, you know, something very different for you and me and any other person in our audience. But we know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, expand on that, Richard. I think that's a very important message. We know what it is.
At least we know what it is in our fantasies. The things that get us off, not just physically off, but, you know, in our sexual revelries, in our fantasies, in the things that, you know, we read, like erotica, for example. What are the things that, you know, make us all tingly all over, that make us feel alive, that make us feel like we are worthwhile and lovable and capable of loving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of those things, whatever it is, it could be just intimate touch, it could be sensual massage, it could be intercourse, it could be all kinds of things, it could be kinky sex, it could be all kinds of things. And everyone is different. So that when somebody, Cheryl, myself, you, any of us, talk about this kind of thing, we always try to preface it by saying, well, you interpret that, you know, through your own filter. Like, I can't tell you what is good hot sex for you. That's something that you discern yourself.
And the filter is often a result of many years of experience and being a sexual person, either learning how to be a sexual person or being a sexual person and sorting through and finding out what are turn-ons and what are turn-offs,
you think? And sometimes we learn, unfortunately, sometimes we learn because something is painful or hurtful or uncomfortable, and, you know, either psychologically or physically, and we have to stop doing that. I mean, I've worked with women over the years, I trust you have too, where their sexual expression has been difficult for most of their life. Their husband or their male lover, absolutely clueless about female sexual response, you know, just hopped on, got off, and then rolled over. And there was nothing about them or their pleasure, And so, but they learned that this, you know, it's not good sex. You know, just because it's with my husband or my boyfriend or somebody that I care about doesn't make it good hot sex. So sometimes we learn things through a really unfortunate sort of way.
And then on the other side of things, I have worked with couples where the woman really does have painful intercourse, either once through penetration and somewhere in the vagina, or she might even have vaginismus, the contraction of the vaginal opening, and where penetration is even difficult. But then the male partner will withdraw because he begins to associate sex, and so does she actually, with pain.
Right.
So then it all gets really complicated.
Right.
And
but there, you know, you stop and, you know, rebuild.
The
foundation, that's what my counsel is always. Even for sick, elder, and dying people, my counsel is always the same. Go back to the foundation and start building again. If what you had put in place is no longer serving you, or it is uncomfortable or not possible at this time, then go back to the foundation, which is often, you know, fantasy and masturbation, and start building from there. And, you know, it's an effort, but it's a bonding experience. I mean, couples who take that seriously go, oh my goodness, it's like we're kids again. You know, it's this unfortunate life circumstances that happened that made us do this, but we are enriched by the process.
Yeah. I think that's if more couples could kind of have that sort of awareness, that even epiphany, which you can inspire with your clients. Isn't that true?
I think so. If you want to give up, give up. And then, then walk away. But if you're sitting in my office, that is a suggestion to me that you're not willing to give up. And, you know, that's all. I'm going to be here as a, you know, I'm going to cheer you on from the sides. I'm going to suggest things. I'm going to, you know, we'll work. I'll walk with you through this with you. But it's going to be your work. And remember that your work is going to enrich you. I mean, don't do it for me. Do it for yourself. Do it for your partner. And people are resistant to that often until they get the hang of it. You know, it's a new thing. You know, it's just like, oh, remedial, and, you know, gee, we shouldn't have to do this, and woe is me, and bad luck, I've got cancer, or bad luck at this, and bad.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you're going to sit on the pity pot, fine and dandy. Do that, and then as soon as you're finished with that, come and see me, because I've got lots and lots of wonderful things that I want to tell you. But I can't tell you them while you're sitting on the pity pot.
Oh, bravo. And, of course, there's so many messages. I was just talking to a client recently, and I told her about this show. And she has had cancer and is still getting some chemo, mild, but still chemo.
Yes, absolutely.
Monthly. And she said, revealingly, well, I probably need to hear this show or get the book because I need to better face death.
Right. Because even if she doesn't die of the cancer, she's going to die at some point. If life presents you an opportunity to face your mortality, why not? I there are a lot of people who are very superstitious about this, and I think we talked about this last week a bit, is that, you're like, oh, my goodness, if I talk about death, if I contemplate my own death, that'll only hasten it. Well, that's silly because, I think about summer vacation all the time, and it never brings summer vacation any faster.
Such a good point, Richard. Yeah, and the subtitle of your book is Enhancing the End of Life.
Exactly. And we talked again last week about, a good death and a good life being much the same thing, because people are, you know, are often confused about, you know, a good death. Oh my gosh, you know, now there's, you know, performance anxiety and, you know, I have to do things right. I said, no, not at all. I ask you a question. How about, you know, what does a good life mean to you? Immediately they, you know, oh, you know, friends and family and good food and, you know, wine and, you know, travel and, you know, comfort, and that's a good life. Okay, so if you know what a good life is, then probably the same thing is what is also a good death. You know, having friends and family and good food and, you know, all of the things that enrich you at the end of life. And knowing the difference between the gold and the dross, and knowing the difference and getting rid of the dross, all of those things like anxiety and painful relationships and all of those things that get in the way of, you know, having a good life.
So we need to go to the half past the hour break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what Cheryl Cohen-Green talks about in your group and in general, and that's about some really effective things like spoon breathing, guided hand. And by the way, my dear listeners, our dear listeners, this is not just for sick people.
These are
great techniques for really any relationship. So we're going to talk about that when we come back, so stay with us, please. We're back, and I just got to hear my promo, which I haven't heard for a while.
Boy, that sounds like a good show.
It is a good show, and you're making it a really good show by your presence here today, this evening. It's this evening in New York, and people are hearing it at different times, but or archived. But, Richard, I'm so grateful that you're here and sharing your wisdom. To think that you were a Catholic priest for 20 years and then you evolved into being a sex therapist, a sexologist, and really specializing in this area of, well, you specialize in sexuality, but also death and dying. And this is something, I'm so glad you finally got your book published.
I'm sure you're glad too.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think I mentioned last week.
We did, yeah.
That I wrote this book, The Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, Enhancing Life Near Death, back in 1996 and 97. And I had the greatest of expectations, thinking that, you know, somebody, you know, some publisher would snap this up right away because it was such an interesting concept. And instead of just, you know, talking about death and dying, which, you know, there have been several really good books along those lines, but mine is so different in terms of presentation style and stuff like that. And that, of course, was its downfall because no publisher, they just said, well, we don't know how to market this because it's so unique and it's so different and it's, you know, we've never seen anything like this before. Well, okay. Won't you take a chance? Not a chance. So I waited until 2012. In fact, last year was, last summer was when the book was published finally. My courageous publisher, Nazca Plains Corporation, published it, and I'm eternally grateful to them because it helped break open this conversation that I think people need. And I'm really pleased that, you know, there's absolutely glowing reviews on Amazon about the book. And, you know, this is a hard topic. You and I have talked about this. This is a hard topic for most people, but, you know, once you start the book, It's a joyful experience. It's very compelling. It's, you know, you're involved with, you know, 10 fictional characters, this on-the-page group that walk through all the complete process with you. You're never alone, and you get to do all these wonderful exercises and opportunities to express yourself so that at the end of the workbook, you have this wonderful legacy that you can pass on to anyone else. And in the process, the workbook provides you an opportunity to talk with your lawyer, with your doctor, with your intimate partners, with your spiritual advisor, about these very important aspects of the end of life?
It's crucial. And you have, I love your My Check-In.
Right.
And so then you provide on those pages lines. So I'm looking at page 264, where you're saying, take all the time and space you need for your check-in. This week I'd like you to include your own end-of-life concerns. Begin by responding to last week's homework. So then the person with this workbook can write down
right.
their end-of-life concerns. Their loved ones can read it before their death or after their death, but again, it's like a legacy, isn't it?
Right. And it opens an opportunity for the conversation. You know, the big elephant in the room that, you know, we're all mortals and that we're all
mm-hmm.
dying, that's going to be dying at some point, and yet we avoid it like the plague, literally and figuratively. And, you know,
yeah.
it does us no service because that same mentality of relegating this to let's pretend like it's not here, when
mm-hmm.
it really comes to roost in our life, as it will, we find ourselves, that's what we've inherited. And
mm-hmm.
because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've been participant in our culture's denial of death.
So, exactly. So let's, as we promised before the break, let's talk about spoon breathing and the guided hand, because these are wonderful approaches, wonderful techniques for any couple.
Right.
Any couple, whether they're straight or gay or completely healthy or sick or old or young. So let's talk about that.
Good. Just a little bit of preview. We have these 10 people. They're this group participants, and Cheryl is in the group, and this is chapter 6. She's come mm-hmm. to address the group about sexuality and intimacy concerns. And the group members have their homework from the previous week. There's 5 questions that I asked them to consider. We can talk about that at some other time. And
oh, no. Why don't you, can you give just a sure. brief overview of those 5 questions?
On page 77, if you have
yeah.
your book open.
Yeah.
And it's the at-home work for week 5, and it's titled Some Questions About Sexuality and Intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the instructions mm-hmm. read, here are 5 simple questions to help you focus your attention on your sexuality and intimacy needs. Number 1, how important is sexuality in your life?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Number 2, is there a difference between sexuality and intimacy?
Mm-hmm.
Number 3, do you have a range of options in which to experience your sexuality? If yes, what are some of them?
Mm-hmm.
Number 4, how well are you able to communicate your needs for sex and or intimacy to your partner or partners? Are there any specific issues that get in the way of you asking for what you need? And number
that's
5...
That's a
one.
Profound question right there.
And number 5, what are your biggest concerns about your sexuality as it relates to your disease, aging, and or dying process?
Mm-hmm.
So now, the participants, the person reading the book as well as the participants in the group, have a whole week to consider these kinds of things. They come to the group, and here is Cheryl, and she invites the group members to start talking about these things. And one of the women in the group, her name is Claire. She's an elderly woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's pretty close to death. She's got cancer. It's reoccurred. She's this marvelous, absolutely brilliant, wonderful, wonderful woman.
Yes.
Who is one of my favorites in the book.
Yes.
Anyhow, Claire, you know, identifies the problem that she was having with her husband of many, many years, and that is that she has this need to be close to her husband, but
mm-hmm.
he's afraid to touch her. He's afraid, right. You know, he doesn't know, he's afraid that he's going to hurt her, or he's just afraid. And he's frightened that she's going to die soon, and he's completely unprepared. And Cheryl gives this woman, Claire, some suggestions about how she could invite her husband to involve himself without fear that, you know, he's going to hurt her, because they're going to spoon to her back and his arm around her side, and then she takes her husband's hand in her hand and then moves it across her body in the fashion that she finds pleasurable and soothing. So instead of him fumbling around and being afraid that, oh, am I touching too hard or not in the right place or whatever, and making himself really anxious, all he has to do is cuddle with her. And then she takes his hand and moves it, you know, to her heart or her face. And this is the epitome of intimacy and sexuality for this particular couple at this particular time. And it changes their life.
Because the husband's fears have been eliminated, because his wife kind of took the lead with spooning and with the hand guiding.
Right. And, you know, she tells the group that, you know, because of the pain medication she's on, the end-of-life pain medication she's on, she often slips away into sleep. And she is invited to tell her husband, don't leave the bed, you know, stay with me. And, you know, because you need this as much as I do. I mean, you know, I almost get tears in my eyes thinking about this, because it's so profound. And, you know, and once the permission is given, once the husband has permission, like, oh, I know what to do. I know what to do to help myself, and I know what to do to help my beautiful dying wife, and I'm going to do it now, because I've been told, and we've figured it out together.
Yeah. So this Claire is fortunate, because she has a husband, she has a partner. There are people in your group. I guess Raul is one of them, but he's a young guy.
Yes.
What about older people that don't have a partner, and yet they're longing for touch, for soothing touch? And what do we do about these people? Because, it's makes me almost cry if I think about it.
It's true. I mean, and earlier on in the book, a couple of the people, you know, who are single, who, because of the death of their partner or for whatever reason, are single, you know, they talk about, you know, their intimacy concerns even before we get to chapter six, and, you know, how they're lonely. And, you know, their loneliness compounds the fact that they're sick, elder, or dying. And my suggestion was, from the very beginning of the book, is that there's, you know, loneliness is a terrible thing, but to be lonely alone is the worst. So, how do we form relationships? I mean, they don't have to be sexual relationships to have intimacy. I mean, you know...
Oh, that's true. So expand on that, Richard. That's very good, yes.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of seniors live in senior complexes.
Yeah.
And a lot of seniors develop relationships with other seniors, same-sex and other-sex relationships.
Yeah.
And what would prevent, you know, two senior women, for example, being intimate with one another, not genital... doesn't have to be a genital kind of thing, but it has to be intimacy. Why couldn't two senior women do the exact same thing, spoon with one another, comfort one another, you know, in the same way a woman would comfort her child? It doesn't have to involve genitals. It only has to involve, you know, compassion. And, you know, And we could offer this to one another, and you know, it could be life altering. I mean, imagine how different life in, you know, a senior complex could be if that was available. If people reached out and said, you know, I just want to be touched. I just want to be held. Could you do that for me? I mean, we of course risk the chance that somebody would say, you know, under no circumstances, that's not for me. But then you just move on to somebody else. You know, so
right.
God knows that those complexes full of seniors, you know, they're lonely alone, and that's a crime.
Lonely alone. So I've always thought that, because as you know, I'm also a gerontologist, so I've always been interested in aging,
yes.
And especially, of course, aging and sexuality. But lots of old ladies get their hair done a fair amount because it's a legitimate way
exactly.
to be touched.
Exactly that.
Yeah. I mean, they get
exactly
their head
that.
Massaged.
Exactly.
They might even, if the... salon person is good, they might get their neck and shoulders
yes.
massaged
right.
as they get a shampoo.
Right.
And we know that so many old people are not touched enough.
Right.
It's touch deprivation.
Absolutely.
And even if they don't have a chronic illness.
That's right.
Know.
And, you know, it compounds everything else. I mean, if I'm, you know, going through a disease process, touch deprivation compounds that. Considerably.
Absolutely.
If I'm trying to recuperate from chemotherapy and or surgery, that is compounded, or radiation. Because I am not being touched. And maybe I don't want to be touched in the way that I was touched before the surgery
yeah.
or the intervention or whatever it was. But I still need touch, and maybe I could find out how I want to be touched if you help me with it. And, you know, by putting it out there, and that's why I made the questions like I did, the at-home question, at-homework questions, before we get to Chapter 6, because I wanted it to, you know, people to ask themselves, like, what do I need? If I need touch, if I need intimacy, if I need companionship, if I need sex, how do I go about asking for it? And who do I ask, for example?
Betty Friedan, who of course wrote a life-changing book for lots of women 40 plus years ago, The Feminine Mystique, she also wrote The Fountain of Age.
Yes.
And she said in that book, and I think it must be 15 years old now, that one solution for lots of older women is to find another older woman with whom they can have some intimacy,
right?
Which you described so well as I need some compassion. I need to be held.
Right.
Would you do that? I like that.
Yes. Women have always been socialized in just about every culture that I know of to be this compassionate, loving, caring kind of
mm-hmm.
person. And sometimes when they have no one to comfort and care for. You know, when their nest is long empty and their husbands are dead, you know, this withers and makes their life miserable. They have to give in order to be alive.
Mm.
And so...
That's profound. That's great. Yes, women have to give to feel alive.
And if they cannot give, they wither. So, I mean, if they could give to one another... You know, when my mother was living in a senior complex in San Jose, and I would go visit and oftentimes have lunch with her in this very lovely complex, and, you know, the women would dress for lunch and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
and they'd carry their purse. I'm like, I don't know, where are you going to use your purse? Anyhow,
yeah.
but they would touch one another's hands while, you know, we're talking, and, you know, you could tell that there was this great desire to give more, but, you know, the conventions of, you know, modern life and, you know, our confusion about the difference between sexuality and intimacy often get in the way, and people are confounded and often stymied in being the very person that they are called to be, that they've always been all of their life, and then suddenly it stops, and they don't know what to do with all of this, you know, compassionate, loving energy to give to somebody else because no one asks for it.
Actually, I see it in my 91-year-old mother.
I bet. I'll absolutely bet.
Because I was a very fortunate little girl because I had parents who loved me and loved each other.
Yeah.
So I got that secure attachment.
Yeah.
But with all of the children, her children now, grandchildren and some great-grandchildren, I don't think she has the outlets to give. That's why it really resonated for me, because that's an insight for me. I love doing this show because I get new insights, too.
It's true.
That
yeah,
women
absolutely
have to give to feel alive. And that's my mother.
Yes. And then imagine if you are living but not feeling alive. What torture is that?
Oh, yeah.
So it all comes down to asking. Someone has to break open the conversation. Can you touch me? Can you hold me?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and sometimes life circumstances allow for that. You know, like if somebody is hurt or if somebody dies or something like that, we comfort the person who survives or who was hurt, and we hold them. And you know, that natural capacity and, you know, that feels so good for the giver as well as the one being held. And it all works, but sometimes those opportunities don't present themselves until we ask for them. And how bad could it be? I mean, how bad could we? You know, we do that. You know, as young people, we try to figure out who's interested in being close to us physically,
yeah,
either by touch or intimacy or even sexuality, and we have to ask. You know, are you interested in being sexual with me? Are you interested in, you know, cuddling with me? We learn how to do that, so why do we have to get rid of it when, you know, we're older and without a partner?
I'm just recalling that about 15 years ago, and I was then living with my husband, Charlie, who died. But at the time, he was very much alive, and my elderly aunt, who was then in her late 80s, came to visit us in Honolulu. And she was this tiny little woman, and Charlie was a big guy. He was 6'3", and he was we called him Charlie Bear because he was such a good hugger. So I said to my Auntie Florence, I said, "Now, you're going to be with us for a week, and if you need a hug from Charlie or from me, you ask for it."
Right.
Oh, she got right with the program. She loved it.
Yes.
And it made her trip, her time in paradise, truly memorable. Right. She told me later. And, you know, she lived to be 96, but she was pretty frail at the end. But, boy, I instructed Charlie, "Now hug her," but, you know, not a real big bear hug because she's a little fragile. But that meant a lot to her,
right,
to have that kind of touch.
Right. So giving permission. You know,
giving permission.
That is the basis of what we do as sex therapists. I'm gathering that's how it is in your practice. It certainly is in mine.
Absolutely,
Just saying, you know, why not give this a try?
Mm-hmm.
And how life-altering would it be?
Mm-hmm.
And if you need to adjust your approach some, you do it. You adjust your approach. And or if you need to, you know, try somebody new, try somebody new. I mean, you know, how difficult is it going to be to find somebody who is equally needy as you? It's, you know, we're all like that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I can't even remember a time when somebody says, "Do you mind if I hug you?" Or, "Could I give you a hug?" And I said, "No, because I don't."
No, of course not.
I need that. I know that about myself. And
of course.
You know, good, good, good.
It's very good. Richard, you are a remarkable man. I am so glad that I know you and that you've been my guest for the last 2 hours, this week and last week. and definitely we'll have you back. We seem to have a pretty easy conversation about all of these things, and I'm grateful for that.
That's because you're alert, and you are aware of your own mortality, and that's what makes this show possible. Because, as I mentioned to you at the end of last week's show, I mean, I am so grateful that you have taken the chance to introduce your audience to this very difficult topic. You know, I mean, you could easily have gotten away with something other for these last 2 weeks, but you chose this. And that's only because you are comfortable being a mortal. And I'm joining you in that, and you know, and we're connecting because we both know that life is short, and what we make of it is our own making.
Well, beautifully, beautifully articulated. Richard, you are just the best, and I want people to get your book and The Amateur's Guide to Death and Dying, Enhancing the End of Life. It's a book that you must have, listeners. So I will write up a description of this show, and we'll give people a link to that. And you'll be back, Richard.
Thank you.
You have so much to offer, and I'm very grateful, and thank you so much.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Diana, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone in our audience, too.
Yes, I concur. Happy Thanksgiving, and it's always a good thing to stop and count your blessings, isn't it?
It sure is.
You're a blessing, Richard. Thank you again. And goodbye, everybody. I may have a repeat show next week, but the week after that, it'll be an interesting show with Candida Royale, Nina Hartley, and Richard Pacheco. Yeah, the golden age of porn, and quite well, a little shift here. So, bye, Richard. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye. Cosa leggera.